So how are you guys doing out there? Have you started building a house yet?
No, we ended up buying another lot. Well, so I got that all subdivided
Yeah.
into 2-acre lots. So there's 4 2-acre lots. And during the Biden administration, near the end, Jessica kind of changed her mind. She didn't want to be out there. There was a lot of activity of people crossing the border and coming right through
Oh,
there.
is that one of the corridors right through the bombing range?
Right.
Oh my gosh, huh?
Yeah, and I was surprised as well, but the military were just kind of hands off because they didn't want to interfere with Border Patrol,
Right.
and so it was this corridor, and there was a lot of Border Patrol activity even on our property. So there was an event where I wasn't there; I was at work. But Jessica's like, "You won't believe what happened today," she said. About 7 or 8 unmarked vehicles just like came up onto our property. It sloped up, and with their weapons drawn, looking for something. They're on our property looking
My
for something
gosh.
somewhere. And so she's like,
Trying to get out of Dodge.
exactly. So we ended up buying a property, a lot over in Heritage Park. I don't know if you're familiar with that. It's an old Bryan Hall subdivision that they started maybe back in like the early 90s. And just over time, it's been filling up. So
Where's that at?
it's off of 5E and 13, I think,
Okay.
County 13 around there. Yeah. There are 2-acre lots there too. More of like a subdivision than where we're at. We're just out in the
Right,
boonies, out in the
right.
desert, which is fun too. But at the same time, you get good and you get bad. We get pounded by the wind and the sand. So there's constant, like, just weathering of everything,
Right.
So Jessica said she'd had enough and said that would have been nice to
So
know.
did you sell it?
No. I think what we'll do is we'll use it for leverage. So maybe pull out some equity off of those lots. Two of them are John and
I was
Claudia's.
going to say, so do they still want to wind up out there? Or?
No, they ended up buying a lot in this Heritage Park.
Oh,
So
okay.
yeah. And then we'll just kind of sell those off, or probably hold them right now during the building phase just to pull money out, use them for liquid cash if I can. If that was the goal. I mean, I don't know. You're the connoisseur of building and properties, so
I don't know about that yet.
uh-huh.
I finally got that acre and a half that I had for tried to sell for years, and then Bob Latinder wanted to do something with it, and we had it all drawn up, the plans and everything. He was ramrod, and I told Bob I didn't have time. I didn't have time to do it. I says, I'll put the land up. You do the
Paperwork or whatever.
groundwork,
Oh, I see. I
and
see.
you just as you sell a lot, give me 1/7 of my 400 grand. And that was our deal. And then he died. After we had the plat was all it's turned
Oh,
in.
surveyed and all that
Yeah,
stuff.
all it's all drawn.
Approved.
Well, no, it was all drawn up, and it was ready. We were ready to send it in to the city for review, and he passed away. So then I'm like, well, I was so busy. This was only a year and a half or so ago. I was so busy. I didn't even give it much thought. I don't have time to deal with it. And then the engineer, V&A Vega, I don't know if you know V&A. He was the engineer that platted it for us. And about a year after Bob passed away, he calls me up and says, "Hey, what are you going to do with that property?" And I go, "Well, I don't know. I right now I don't have time or money to do it." And he says, "Well, what was your deal with Bob?" And I told him. He says, "Well, would you do that with me?" I said, "Heck yeah." So I don't know if you've been by that way
I
lately.
have not been there for a long time.
Okay, it's already it looks like it's ready to start building on. It's the cul-de-sac's been paved. All the utilities are in. It's been fenced in. So, yeah, he gave me $150 down, and I'm carrying the balance.
Very cool.
And with interest, and so I expect to get my other $250 here. Probably, I would think within a few months, hopefully.
That's awesome. Very cool.
Yeah.
Whatever happened with that one huge house right by you that had like the dome, and I think it had like a chapel inside or something.
It was bought many years ago, and they finished it out.
Somebody came in and finished it.
I've never been inside. I've talked to him and his wife a couple of times. Just, you know, they're walking the neighborhood, and we chatted for a long time. He owns the liquor store on the big curve. Across from Boot Barn, that strip there, he owns that, and he tried to set up another liquor store on 16th and First Avenue there, but it didn't go over where that used to be an old Shell station.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to think, you're making enough money from a liquor store to have that house? So I don't know if he has other properties or something.
So Chris Strebe, our guest for the show today, welcome to Life, Death, and the Law.
Thank you.
What are you doing these days? You working full time?
Working full time, trying to figure out a exit plan, maybe a 5-year exit plan.
Uh huh. Maybe.
Pardon?
So is it maybe 10 or maybe 3? You say maybe 5-year exit plan.
Oh. No, it needs to be 5 years.
Okay.
Maximum.
Maximum 5 years. Yeah. If it happens sooner, then the better.
It'd be nice.
What's the exit plan?
Not sure yet. Hopefully I can get I have three sons and a son-in-law and a grandson part-time that work for me.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully down the road I can get them up to speed on my part of the business that I run. They know how to do all of their individual tasks and each other's tasks out in the shop and out in the field. But they have no office experience.
So give us a thumbnail sketch of what it is that your business is.
Yeah, so Chris Craft Cabinets, right? And it's been in business for how long?
40 years.
40 years. Mm-hmm. Did you take this over, or did you just one day wake up and say, I'm going to be a carpenter?
No. I started working in the cabinet business when I was 17 in high school. And I worked for this gentleman that had been in the cabinet business. He's only 10 years older than me, but when you're 17, 10 years is, you think the guy's, seems like they're 40 years old.
Yeah.
Minimum. But he was probably the age I was when I started the cabinet shop. That's when he started his cabinet shop. And his brother worked for him, which was my age. I went to school with his brother, and we had auto shop together. And one day we're doing, back in those days in the 70s, is way different as now. The auto shop teacher says, yeah, you need to make a parts run. Go get some parts, spark plugs or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And so we went to, I knew him. He wasn't a friend. He was just somebody I knew from shop. We went to parts store together, and I says, what are you doing for gas money? Because 17 years of age, all you're worried about is gas for your truck.
Yeah.
And he says, oh, I work for my brother in a cabinet shop. And I did a little bit. I had wood shop in junior high. And I says, oh, I like working with wood. And if you ever need help, let me know.
Mm-hmm.
Just passing conversation, never gave it much thought. 3 or 4 months later, we graduate. And during that time, I was working at a restaurant, Tom Tate's Buffet. I was a busboy and then a dishwasher. And not long before graduation, I had quit that job and I was working at Safeway, but I didn't last there very long. I don't think I bagged fast enough.
Yeah. That was one of my first jobs, Safeway.
Was it really?
Yeah. And I always got complained at. Not by the customers, but by the cashiers. They were cranky. Anyway, sorry.
Oh, no worries. So we graduated, which was a very odd feeling. When you walk off that stage with your diploma, it was just like this, what's next? Because I didn't have a plan. I wasn't planning a career or anything like that. And I didn't have a job at the time. And it was just an odd feeling. And so I'm home one afternoon and there's this knock on our door, and his name was Ron Johnson. And he's knocking on my door and I'm like, what's Ron doing here? Because he wasn't a friend. He's just acquaintance from cruising and from school. And this is probably 2 or 3 months after graduation, and goes, hey, you still looking for a job? I go, yeah. And so here I am, 17 years old, going to learn the cabinet trade with him and his brothers, just us three, for a long time. I worked for that gentleman for nine something years.
What type of cabinets were you building?
Back then it was residential. The commercial business of cabinets in the 70s and 80s hadn't really formed as its own thing the way it is now, laminate cabinets and all that. And
really, I thought everything laminate came from the 70s.
Well, sorta, kinda, but they weren't processed and manufactured the way they are now.
Okay.
They were basically a kitchen-style cabinet that had laminate on them.
Mm.
In fact, you know, we did a couple jobs like that. You would build the cabinets like normal, and instead of instead of staining them, you'd laminate them.
Is that high-end?
Back then it was, because it was very labor-intensive.
Uh-huh.
Very labor-intensive to do that. So I worked for him for 9 years, but he was a really hard individual to work for. And the last couple years I was there, I was miserable.
Why?
Well, he was like I said, he was a hard person to work for, and I wasn't getting paid very much.
Mm-hmm.
I was married with one child, maybe two children at that time. And I was just miserable. And back then in the 70s and 80s, we didn't have lumber vendors that came to Yuma once a week to bring your materials. You had to kind of get your materials from the local lumber yards. They didn't really carry a lot of cabinet making materials. If you needed a big job, you'd have to go to Phoenix yourself or San Diego and get them with a truck and trailer. So consequently, the local cabinet shops would trade between themselves. Like if you needed a sheet of particle board or a couple sheets of plywood or something, you just call up one of the other cabinet shops. Hey, you got a sheet, trade or buy? And so there's this old German guy in Yuma that had a cabinet shop in the middle of Okietown there. And it was just him and one other person for 25 years. And he was in his mid-60s, and he was tired and wanted to retire. And he come to borrow a couple sheets of material from Don. And Don says, hey, help Mr. Martin. His name was Martin Binner, an old German guy, very thick accent. And he goes, help Mr. Martin load the two sheets of particle board up. And so I'm helping him. And I says, well, how's it going, Mr. Martin? It's in the middle of the summer. No, yeah. It was hot anyway. He says, well, I'd be doing a lot better if somebody'd buy my shop. And I'm like, whoa, really? And so I didn't really say anything, but that's all I could think about the rest of the day was stopping by and seeing what he had going. Now, before this, my best friend had a landscaping business, and he's a couple years older than me, and he had his landscaping business for 2 or 3 years. And so he was kind of an example to me in the sense of, you should get your own business. You're so miserable. You should just start your own cabinet shop. And it's like, well, easier said than done. I'm thinking I'm only 25 or 26 years old. But he had pressed me for a couple years that I should do something on my own. And so he's a good example to me. So when I stopped by Mr. Benner's on the way home, he said that he would sell me his business with the building with the tools. And he had a couple jobs on the books that could be done for $65,000. I'd have to give him, I can't remember if it was $15,000 down or $25,000 down. No, it was $15,000 down, and he'd carry the note. Now, I hadn't, at 26 years of age, I had never had any real estate experience, so I felt very lucky to be able to have somebody carry the note for me.
Yeah.
My mother-in-law... at the time, my mother-in-law, her and her husband were business people in town. They owned some apartments and a small motel, and they were all for me starting this business because they knew that I knew what I was doing.
Mainly work ethic, mainly that you're a reliable, hardworking person.
Exactly. And I had no concept of running a business. I had no idea what that was.
Yeah, but you would stick it through.
Exactly. She put up the down payment and even gave me a couple thousand dollars to put in the bank for seed money, working capital, so to speak. And I was on my way. It was a very odd feeling in the very beginning to not have knowing that you're going to a job, an hourly wage job, and now you're on your own. But fortunately, he had he had a couple jobs to do. He had about a month and a half's worth of work to do. So I did that and waited for other work to come in or, you know, phone call. I just kept the same number and I didn't even name my business Chris Craft at that time. I kept it Martin's Cabinets. I'd answered the phone for a year, year and a half as Martin's Cabinets. And, consequently, after a month and a half or 2 months or so, a customer from my old employer came wanting a price on a cabinets. They were building a new house, and I think this is their maybe second or third house, and Don had done their cabinets before. Well, they weren't no dummies. They knew that I was the cabinet builder at Don's. Mm-hmm. I was the one actually doing the work. Don didn't really throw a hammer. He was in the office. And so I didn't even know how to price a big custom house at that time.
Did you see the numbers going back and forth, or did you just simply show up and get the work done when you were working with Don?
Oh, no. I had no idea what he charged or anything like that. None at all. I just... He'd hand me some paperwork and says, build these cabinets with measurements on them. And I did it from that. At that time, the last year or two of him being in business there before I left, he had a salesman. So I called this salesman up and I says, hey, how do I bid this job? And he gave me a price list for ordering cabinets. And in those ordering cabinet price lists, it has a retail price on it.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, just take this and figure out how you would do this job with modular cabinets. and just charge them what that retail price is on there. You'll be fine. Well, it was $14,000 is what it turned out to be. And so I typed up, there's no computers back then. I typed up a bid and gave it to them. And they come back and says, wow, we thought you'd be a little cheaper than Don. I guess I was about what Don's price would have been.
Probably just using the same calculations.
Maybe, I don't know. But they went with me. They weren't worried about the price. They just wanted to make sure they got a good job.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I did the job.
So you didn't back down. You didn't.
Oh no!
Give them a counter offer. That
well, they didn't ask for a lower price. They just made a comment.
Yeah, but that's usually enough for me.
Oh yeah.
Hopefully, none of my clients are listening to this. But, enough for me to go, oh yeah, well, we could do it cheaper, and then I keep undercutting myself until I'm actually working for free.
So I did that job, and I got paid, and as when it was all said and done, I had $5,000 in the bank, and that was the last time I had $5,000 in the bank for many years.
Why?
Because when I had to do it all myself, when I worked for Don, I built the cabinets, but he turned it. But his brother did the sanding and staining and finishing, and then another guy, a couple guys, did the install. And here I am by myself. Now I'm doing all of those parts, plus running the business. Now at that time, there's not a lot of business to run. But then I got more work, and I'm starting to see the benefit. Oh, I need to back up. Mr. Martin didn't have hardly any tools. He had a table saw, a nail gun, an air compressor, and some hand tools. Well, when I worked at Don's, I was used to a lot more equipment.
Mm-hmm.
We had an edge bander and a big panel saw, not a table saw, and just so I was used to using more productive machinery. And so I was taking my profits and buying tooling so I can do a better job. The problem is that I couldn't like go to the bank and get a loan for this stuff. I would just buy it as I went. And for 2 or 3 years there, I was kind of robbing Peter to pay Paul. And it's a vicious cycle, very vicious cycle. And it only took me a couple years to figure out I had to get out of that.
It's interesting that you wouldn't buy a more efficient tool, get the job done quicker, and just realize that, oh, okay, now I get to keep more of the $5,000, whatever the profit margin is.
Well,
how come that didn't work?
Okay, it's a good question. Because when you are in the robbing Peter to pay Paul cycle, you're worried about getting the next job because you got to get that deposit so that you can pay.
Oh, so you're paying for the tools for the current job off of the deposit for the next job.
Exactly, or just running the business. And consequently, your pricing isn't where it needs to be because you're worried about not getting the job.
Yeah.
So you were underbidding yourself.
I was underbidding myself. I didn't, you know, it's like, if I don't get this job,
I can't finish I'm the sunk. Current job.
It's funny you say that because, you know, our in-laws have run a roofing business for generations here, and they've made comments where companies have come and gone so quickly in their field because of that exact issue. They'll get these bids right off the bat because they're undercutting all the others, but that doesn't last too long, and ultimately they just kind of fizz out and disappear.
You have to make a profit. You You can't do work for cost.
Yeah.
And I never lost money on jobs.
Really?
No, I've never lost money on a job. I've never been stiffed on a job. The one time I thought that I was got stiffed $2,500 for a job, I had filed a, it was in El Centro, and so I filed a pre-lien. And I think 10 years went by, and I got a call from some California attorney. He says, hey, this individual is a hotel,
mm-hmm.
one of a privately built hotel, not a chain or anything. And the attorney says, they're trying to sell this property, and we see that you have a lien against this. Because I had perfected the lien.
Wow.
And he says,
well, I mean, the sophistication to do that is something that generally only seasoned businessmen know how to do. And even then, they don't do it very, very frequently or correctly.
Well, this was back in the 80s when that recession was going on. And,
uh-huh.
And it was out of town. It wasn't a contractor I knew. And I'd seen other people get stiffed because they hadn't done it. So, but I had forgotten it. My accountant had written it off, and I get this call, and I get, all these years later, I got a check for $2,500.
That's great.
So yeah, I've been very fortunate, and I, part of it is because I've been careful. I think, I mean, I've been able to, have a little bit of discernment if I want to do a job or not, if somebody seems a little flaky.
Yeah. And when, I guess I'd like to know the point in your career when you stopped underbidding what your true value of your services were, when you said, okay, this is what I'm worth, and if they're not going to pay that price, I'm okay not taking that job.
Well, that was in my first, at Robin Peter to pay Paul Cycle was probably maybe year two, three, and four. That, I don't know if it went on quite that long, but, I just had the common sense to realize I can't keep doing this. And, I would suspect that maybe a little bit too. It's just divine intervention.
Do you ever listen to Mike Rowe? He's got a podcast now. He was the host of Dirty Jobs.
I know who he is. I've heard some of his stuff, but I've never regularly listened to any of his stuff.
Well, he's got a foundation that he runs that he's really advocating for trades jobs like mechanics,
oh yeah,
craftsmen, plumbers, just anything that helps build America, the industry. And he offers scholarships for individuals to do that. He often quotes a statistic that for every five tradesmen that leave, only two fill their position. And we are facing a major labor shortage, and that is going to be a significant struggle in our economy, is finding people to do the work, to build, to the electricians that we need to be out there doing things. And so many people have been indoctrinated that you have to go to college in order to make a living. And in your case, that robbing Peter to pay Paul is a business concept that a kid would go to college and learn on paper. Man, it may stick and it may not, and he may get a B on that final course. But whether or not he understood the concept would be questionable. But you, when you learn it that way, it sticks. And it applies in a way that you're not going to let it happen again, and you move forward. What would you recommend? What advice would you give to somebody that's graduating high school today and in the same position you were in? I don't know what I'm going to do now. The answer for most is, well, you go to college and you incur a bunch of debt and you go to a bunch of liberal arts courses and learn who you are and what you love. And then if you do what you love, then of course the paycheck must follow if we were living in a socially just society. What would you say to that type of individual?
It's a tough question in the sense that I only went to AWC for 1 year. And the only reason I did that was because I got a presidential scholarship. I was in, I don't know, the top, I don't know what percentage I was. I was up there though in my graduating class. And I don't even know how I got that scholarship. I don't know if a counselor signed me up for it or if it was just automatic.
Mm-hmm.
But I was totally surprised when I went to get my diploma on the stage and they said that I had also gotten a presidential scholarship.
Somebody's looking out for you.
I truly believe that. So I went to AWC for 1 year and then I started the second year. But at that time, I took one of the courses I took was computer programming, and it's a lot different back then. You programmed in BASIC or Fortran or RPG, and you used these punch cards. But I really enjoyed it, and so I thought, well, maybe I'll be a programmer. And you'd read the ads at in the newspaper, and the YPG military base out there had programmers. I don't know. They advertised what the hourly rate was for them. I'm like, and I'm doing the cabinets at this point in time. And I'm like, well, shoot, I make that much money doing cabinets.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of didn't worry about that anymore. But I don't, 1 year of college, I wouldn't consider a college education. For somebody that doesn't, my recommendation would be at the very least, go to a local college, because a lot of people will be able to figure out what they like or don't like. And I did kind of figure that out in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Did you live with your parents when you were going to AWC?
I did, yeah.
So you didn't have any real out-of-pocket expenses. None. And, you know, it just sounds to me that you're pretty responsible person, and so you weren't tempted just to blow it off and party and let your grades slip. So that's the temptation that a lot of kids face today. They don't have the type of accountability, and so they say, well, I am going to college. I'm technically at college, and it's on mom and dad's dime, so this is the next thing to do. But the reality of I actually have to get something, whether it's knowledge or a skill, from this college that I'm attending, that somebody is going to pay me for when I get my degree, instead of when I get my degree, that is my golden ticket, and I just turn it in, and then I get a paycheck in return.
Correct.
So knowing that, and I know you've raised, would you say four sons?
Well, I have five sons and four daughters.
Five sons and four daughters. What advice would you give?
My children have never asked me for advice on that, and I've never given it. It's
classic children-father relationship.
It is.
Do you sit there and watch, though? I mean, do you get frustrated as a dad sometimes where you're like, oh man, I just want to step in. If you would just do this, I know you'll be better, or you'll be more successful. Or is it
easy
to just kind of watch in the fringe?
I'm not a helicopter parent, and neither is my wife. We believe in agency. And
what does that mean when you say you believe in agency? It's easy to say that, but what does that mean?
That,
like, dive down a little bit into that.
Sure. To let agency would be for an individual to take their own course, make their own decisions. But as a parent, we make sure that they understand that there's consequences to their decisions and that they have to man up to whatever those consequences are.
And I think society's pretty good at explaining the first half of that, but we're pretty terrible of allowing individuals to fully experience the second part of it, the consequence.
You have to let them experience that second part. My friend had a son, a teenage son that he had a hard time with. And it almost came to blows once.
Mm-hmm.
And he called the cops on his son. And the cops took him away. And for overnight, and it was juvenile detention. And he left him there for 2 days.
That's a lesson. And is that still an option?
And that child, he did a 180 after that.
I
was amazed. You guys might know who I'm talking about. I don't know, but
I have an idea, but I don't know. I'd much rather go to the blows though. And get the cops involved.
Seriously?
Oh, absolutely.
You're so tough when you and when you talk at them, but I've seen you parent your kids. You coddle them.
My boys though. I mean, if my boys, I mean, you have to let them know that I still got it. And I've got dad strength.
Mm.
Like a superpower.
I think my boys all, I'm not going to say they were afraid of me, but I think they knew not to
poke the bear.
Yeah, that'd be a good.
I felt the same way towards my dad. And at the time, I didn't think, well, this is a healthy relationship. I just thought there are things that you say and don't say. And there's a
little. What?
Huh?
Or else what? What would you worry about?
I didn't know what the consequences would be. I just knew that I was scared. And today, you know, my kids, they'll knock on my door, then they'll knock on my bathroom door, and then they'll come in. And if I'm saying I'm getting dressed, then they'll say, well, how dressed are you? And they'll still try to. And I'm like, listen, at what level is there like privacy, respect? Mm-hmm. And my wife will say, well, you know, you don't want your kids to be afraid of you. I'm like, yeah. Yeah, I was afraid of my dad. Weren't you afraid of your dad? And she was like, yeah, but it was in a healthy way. And I'm like, sure. But at the same time, my kids feel like I'm their buddy. And I didn't try to get it that way. And I tried to like disabuse them of that opinion by getting after them. But then I think when I leave home, I think that they maybe are treated with kid gloves a little bit. Now I'm throwing my wife under the bus. I'm trying not to, but they do get coddled. And I do want them to know that, yes, there's a level of respect that goes with me being their dad and the fact that I don't just leave the house all day and then magically I come home and the lights work and the house is there and food is on the table. Like, I take responsibility for taking care of my children, and in return, they need to show some respect and follow through on their chores and the responsibilities that they have as members of the family. And I can say that till I'm blue in my face, but until there's some type of consequence, until they go without the latest pair of shoes that they want or jeans or activity that they want to go to because they haven't followed through, they're not going to learn that. And we have a really hard time allowing the consequence. And I don't think that's just my family. I think that's society in general to play out.
Do you feel like did you rule the house with an iron fist?
No.
No,
no,
not at all. Were you there? I mean, as a small business owner, you were probably, it's not the luxury of going to work 8 to 5. It's, you got to get the job done. That takes weekends. It takes late nights. And so do you feel, looking back now, were you in the home as much as you wanted to be?
No, I don't. As a business owner, especially one where I wear many hats in my business. Too many hats. And between work and family and church, you don't have a lot of free time. But I, you know, we had none of our kids was into sports much except for last couple sons. And so, you know, I'd make sure I'd try to make their track meets. And of course, our daughters are in dance and singing and stuff. So, you know, I'm always able to make those recitals and stuff and enjoy them. And, you know, we recreate together. So I'm hoping in the end it was enough. None of my kids or grandkids are in jail. So I think I'm okay.
Knock on wood. All right.
Yeah.
Well, we have so many questions, Chris, but we got to go.
Okay.
Can you believe how fast time has gone?
Fast.
But I want to pick your brain about business, because it sounds like 40 years of experience has just been awesome.
Sure.
But we got to go. So maybe we'll have you back.
Yeah, I'd love to.
And I think this is really good, just sound advice for the listeners out there. You don't have to be the smartest. You don't have to be the fastest. You don't have to be out there working till midnight. What you do have to do is take responsibility for what you say. Don't overpromise, but deliver on what you do say. And there is that cliche, under promise and over deliver. I don't think you have to do that. Say what it is going to be and then do that. And I think when people get a fair deal, they know it and they appreciate it.
I do have one more thing to say to future business people. To add to that, don't work for wages. You will never have a successful business if you work for wages. You'd be surprised how many people out there feel guilty about making profit. And it just boggles my mind that they have that mindset. You have to cover.
It's being taught in our schools.
Is it?
That is greed. In order for you to make money off of somebody else's labor, without understanding the fact that without that profit, there would be no job for that laborer to receive any wages in the first place.
That's right. You have to cover your expenses, put a fair wage in for you, and then you put a profit. You'll never be able to get to the point where you want to get to if you don't put a profit in there.
Great advice. Good job.
Thank you, Chris. Right.
Thank you for having me.